This episode of With Love and Justice for All is brought to you by Bliss Books and Wine. Bliss Books and Wine is an independent black-owned bookstore for wine enthusiasts and book lovers. Listed as one of the black-owned bookstores in America that amplify the best in literature by OprahDaily.com, Bliss Books and Wine is your go-to for all your favorite titles, including ebooks and audiobooks. And when we buy from black-owned businesses, we are helping to create a world of racial equity. When ordering online, use the code 846BOOK for a 10% discount. That's 846BOOK for a 10% discount at blissbooksandwine.com.
Exploring the healing and culture building practices of embodied anti-racism. This is With Love and Justice for All with Reverend Ogun Holder and Reverend Kelly Isola.
Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 119 of With Love and Justice for All, the official podcast of Project Sanctus, where we have conversations around embodied anti-racism, dismantling oppression, fostering liberation, with a special eye to the challenges that arise for spiritual seekers. I am Reverend Ogun, one of your co-hosts, along with my partner in crime consciousness and co-creation, Reverend Kelly. How are you today, Reverend Kelly? It's been a while, hasn't it?
It's been too long a while. And that's what happens when life goes on.
I was going to say, when you make plans, what does it say? People plan and God laughs. Yes,
that's something like that. Yeah. Something and not like just that. God, other people around.
Exactly. So we had plans and plans went awry for other episodes, but here we are again. And we thank our listeners who stick with us all over the US, 30 countries around the world. We really appreciate you following, listening, sharing, and you can connect with us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, our handles at Get Our Holy On. Leave a message on our voicemail, 413-GET-HOLY or 413-438-4659 if you don't have letters on your phone. But also hit us up online at projectsanctus.com where you will see the fun things. And I use fun loosely, the fun things that we have going on along in our journey to dismantle systems of oppression. Yeah.
I had to chuckle at the fun things because I'm like, yeah, I don't, every once in a while, I'm not sure all this self-reflecting is fun.
And we do it with a certain flair that makes it
that's
fun.
That's true. But I don't, yeah. I every once in a while, I don't know about you, but I have moments where I don't want to know more about me.
there's that. Yeah. Everything in moderation.
Right. And it is a lifelong thing. It is a lifelong journey. And I know if I'm, you know, we've talked about this oodles of times. If I'm pushing to do something, you know, that sense of pushing and urgency and got to get her done, I'm reproducing the very thing that I'm critiquing and I'm reproducing the systems of oppression. So,
yes. Speaking of systems of oppression, today we're going to take a look at capitalism. We're going to dismantle capitalism today. So,
not just today, in two episodes, we'll have it completely dismantled.
Exactly. Completely dismantled in two episodes. So, you're welcome, everyone listening. So today we're going to take a look at realizing reparations, and next episode it'll be around decolonizing wealth. So before we jump into all of that, give us some heads up about what we got going on.
Sure. We have our, you know, every month we have two affinity groups. One is communal and one is separate. I facilitate a group for white bodies and Ogun facilitates a group for BIPOC people. And the first Wednesday is the communal group. So that's this week. So right now this is Tuesday, April 2nd. So if you're listening tomorrow or April 3rd is the first Wednesday of April. So 7:30 Eastern time, join us in our communal group. They are for everybody. It is probably the most powerful, effective way in affinity groups to learn how you are complicit in systems of oppression, how you, and not on purpose, not because we're bad people, it's because that's the water we've been swimming in and drinking and having it ooze into our pores. And then, but you need to register for that to get the Zoom link. So you can go to projectsanctus.com and go to the affinity groups and sign up for the communal one, as well as the the separate ones, the affinity groups. 7:30 p.m. Eastern, projectsanctus.com. We have our Conscious Anti-Racism self-paced course, which is, you can find on the website. And it's just it's a 5-module course. You can walk yourself through or with others. You know, it's even better if you actually don't do it alone, because doing it alone sort of, you know, keeps that rugged individualism concept going. And I understand, you know, people have schedules and calendars and things, but it's a self-paced course. So you can move through it, obviously, at your own pace. And there's exercises and you know, lots of resources and, you know, Ogun and I talk and there's some reflection questions and things. We have a new 846 book club starting on Monday, April 15th. That'll run through Monday, May 6th. So every Monday at 7:30 Eastern. And the book that we're doing is called The Inverse Cowgirl. It's really good. It's pretty much an autobiography, and it's more than that. So Alicia Rothy, I think it's Weigel. I could be saying that wrong. Could be Weigel. Anyway, she's an activist, and she's on the forefront of fighting for intersex representation and rights. Hence the title, Inverse Cowgirl. And while it's autobiographical and her journey about intersex, she also addresses, you know, all forms of oppression, and it's not just solely about one topic, but how we can, the things we can do to support everybody and anybody that's being, you know, that's not quote unquote in the norm, whatever the norm is, white, cisgender, heterosexual, that kind of thing. It's funny, it's thought-provoking, it's essays, and inviting us to really live our truth. And finally, you can support our work by visiting projectsanctus.com/donate. This is our third anniversary. We've been wandering around doing this for 3 years now. Can you hardly believe it?
Time flies when we're having fun, as they say.
Right.
Again, that fun word. before again we jump into our main topic, and not entirely unrelated, I wanted to mention one thing that happened recently, which is the federal government, for the first time in decades, is updating how it is classifying people by race and ethnicity. And one of the reasons it's doing this is in recognition of the fact that we are an increasingly diverse country, and in many federal forms and like the census.
I think we lost Ogun there for a minute.
Oh my God.
So the US is updating, the census is updating. They announced this almost a week ago, to really, so to better capture, you know, who we are in the United States, and also to give policymakers a fuller view of Americans, because so many of our policies are are just bent a little bit or a lot towards white, middle class, or maybe even middle lower class, but white, heterosexual, cisgender. So doing this, it's been over 25, 30 years since any changes have been made. So they're going to be putting in more questions around race, around ethnicity. They're going to add Middle Eastern or North African as a new category. And that will include 7 different choices. So it's really, for me, it's just really quite momentous and really quite remarkable. And like, thank God, you know, it's one of the biggest changes that we've really ever seen. And they're going to, so the changes are going to show up in multiple federal data collection forms, not just the census that goes out every 10 years, but also other, you know, data collection forms and just federal data that gets collected. So, you know, everything from healthcare to redrawing congressional districts, which we know many of them in many states are gerrymandered, you know, education, science, just multiple agencies and multiple arenas within policymaking and this life we live in here in America that are really going to be impacted in a wonderful way to help, you know, tease out, to help not just tease out, but erase and eliminate, you know, the systemic biases that have been in place for so long, to take another step toward ensuring equal rights and equal protections under the law. So I think that's what you were talking about, Ogun, before the internet took you away from me.
Yes. You were talking about, it's been a while since it's been a change. 2020 in 2020, which when the last census that they took, the category some other race was the second largest racial group in the United States. Some other race, basically people saying all these, the categories you currently have, we don't see ourselves in them. So if you have this many people saying that, yeah, it was time to take a look, time to reassess. And sometimes also there were some ethnicities that, for lack of an option, would also just check white. In fact, that was what was in encouraged before. So, right. So yeah, so this is a good move in order to really, again, recognize that the U.S. is a very diverse nation. And if we say we're going to have a representative government, we got to know who we represent it. Right. So yeah, so that's a good thing. Very good thing. Let's talk about reparations.
Yes. Well, it's reparations is a topic that's been topic of conversation for, I think, for a long time in a lot of places, but never really makes it to, you know, enough to the surface where there's large conversations going on. And so, and the other thing about it is that it's my experience, and I don't know what yours is, but when the word reparations comes up, it's people run, you know, screaming from the room. It becomes something divisive and seems, you know, like it's a very binary thing. You're either for it or you're against it. Like, there's, can we have a conversation first about what a reparation even is and why and how it works? So,
and the multiple ways it can look, because I think, yes, what has the view that's been traditionally held is it means we're going to give money to the descendants of enslaved people somehow. And that number based on the wealth that was accumulated through the free labor of enslaved people. And that number, you know, the estimate for that number varies wildly depending on who you ask, but folks see that number and it scares them. Where would we find that money? Who would we give it to? How would we decide who to give it to? Isn't that unfair? Isn't that reverse privilege?
Right.
You know, stuff like that. So yeah, it's a big question. And the question, like you wisely said, begins with let's talk about what it is first, and even talk about why it's deserved.
Well, I think one of the reasons that people very often leap right to it's about a financial thing is because what we've become accustomed to is watching, you know, convicted felons have to make financial restitution to the victim. So there becomes this, you know, unexamined, unconscious assumption that, you know, reparations is a money thing when, as you said, it's not necessarily, but it is reparations is, you know, making amends, you know, whether that's around money or helping those who have been wronged, you know, making something whole, so to speak. And even that, you know, I've heard that said many times, making something whole, then I feel like, okay, but let's not go anywhere yet. What does make it whole actually mean and look like? And not by my standards, but by whoever has been wronged, right? Whatever group of people have been wronged. And you know, especially it's the topic is around racial harm, you know, slavery, Jim Crow segregation, you know, just the ongoing systemic racism that we still have here in the US. So I don't know where I was going with all that, except that I could feel myself, you know, it can be a very overwhelming topic, and it can be one where people go running from the room because they just think it's money. And you get that, okay, it's been how many years, right? You know, how long has it been? How long are you going to hold on to this? What, you know, all these, what I think are just, I cringe, you know. Especially
well, not only that, but the idea that we live in a society, a culture, whereby folks, people of color, Black folk, are not so oppressed that they can't earn money, earn a life. Shoot, we have Black folk who are, you know, CEOs and CFOs and doctors and all the high earning jobs you can think of. Shoot, we even had a Black president. So why are we going to talk about reparations when, you know, sure, it might have made sense when just after slavery ended or even back in Jim Crow days. But now we, you know, folks have the opportunity to earn. So why are we bringing that old argument back up again and again is, you know, one of the objections. And I think to what you said about the making amends for wrongs, I think that's kind of where we begin to run into an issue because, you know, there's a sense that a wrong happened, but a wrong is no longer happening.
Yes.
And as you know, we know from the numerous of discussions we've had here that that's not objectively true. There are many wrongs that are still happening. But then it becomes again, how do you quantify that in order to have a repairing, a reparation? We've got to be able to quantify it. And I think that's how people have been basically getting away with not having to do anything about it. It's impossible to say how much harm was done. It's impossible to put a number on it, put a sort of deal.
Yeah, and it's beyond 40 acres and a mule kind of thing.
Exactly. Adjusted for inflation, that's like, what, 120 acres and 3 tractors? I don't know.
But I think at the very least, you know, we need to be having the conversation, no matter how uncomfortable, because it is, while it sort of languishes at the federal level, you know, at the local levels and at state levels, there are, you know, things happening. There are actions being taken that, you know, are moving in the direction of, you know, of reparation. And again, it's, you know, who's the reparation for, and what does it look like, and where do you even get started? Like, that's probably one of the things that that will halt a conversation quicker than anything around reparation is, okay, where do you get started? How do you get started? And then nobody seems to know. So it just stops, you know, right. Just sort of stops dead in the tracks. So I think that's what, you know, our conversation is, you know, we called it part one, realizing reparations, I think is the beginning, is having the conversation and understanding what, you know, it's sort of like, you know, being a feminist or an abolitionist, you know, being a reparationist, you know, and it, you know, it's another, that's what I need is another label, you know, to right. hang on my progressive hat. But I think it's, you know, just like abolitionism, like when you see it, you say something. And I think the same is true for reparations, that to, you know, the more I learn about what it is, and it's not always about money, but what can it look like how, you know, pop culture, you know, can shapes the reparations. Like, I mean, I would even say, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, in the news, this around Beyonce and, you know, moving into, you know, country music, and, you know, she got a lot of shit for it. And there's less shit going on around it and more, you know, shining a spotlight on it. And, oh, well, you know, and people learning that pretty much every form of music we have in the United States came from African Americans, you know.
Yep.
So even the learning of that and her stepping into country music and being uplifted, to me, seems like a form of reparation.
Yeah, when we talk about forms of reparations, like we have categories like there can be a restitution, which is you given the thing that was taken back, the actual thing. There's compensation, which is, okay, we can't give you the actual thing back, but, you know, here might be some a monetary value, so we're going to give you money or something else that will kind of equal the value of what was taken. There's this idea of also of rehabilitation, so maybe the harm that was caused by what was taken from you, now we're going to create some conditions and context for you to be healed from that harm. And then there's satisfaction and then guarantees of non-repetition. And that's really the idea of we will stop doing the harmful things that or stop doing the actions that cause the harm in the first place. An act of reparations can include all those elements, or it could be just one of those elements. And I think in many ways, you know, you mentioned Beyonce and making the foray into country, and you know, let's point out that they've been Black country artists all along, from right. like you said, from before it was called country music, and even all the way through it. And on her last album, she does pay tribute to some of those folks and, you know, and mentions how, or she doesn't mention, but it's well documented that a lot of Black country artists, they back in the day, you know, we're talking like 40s, 50s, 60s, when they were recording music, it wasn't shared that they were Black initially. Let's see how the music does first. And if it's successful, then we'll reveal who you are, because people would have automatically, oh, this is a Black person singing, we're not listening to them, or they don't belong in this category. And that still happens in our current time. She experienced that a while back. If you remember Lil Nas X, when he did the Old Town Road yep. song, which was initially when he did it, basically the country music folk were like, yeah, this is not country music, you don't belong here. Right. And then Billy Ray Cyrus re-recorded the song pretty much identically. Like he didn't make any changes other than he was singing a bunch of the parts. And then it could be categorized as a country song because a country artist, a white country artist was singing. You know, so it was, that was the whole thing. So for someone of the stature that Beyonce is in the entertainment world and space, for her to say, you know, let me enter this space as a way of showing that, basically this, to your point, this is an art form that was appropriated by white America, and Black Americans have the right, just as much right, to be in that space as well. And I think that's part of the that category satisfaction, that idea of going like, yes, yes, you do. Welcome back. That can also be part of not so much restitution, because you're not returning it, but opening up to have folks, regardless of their race or their ethnicity, in a space. And again, Black country related folk singers have always existed in the music space in America, but just haven't really been necessarily given their due or their recognition, or in many cases their songs and work were stolen and appropriated. I mean, we've seen this in rock and roll as well. You know, a couple of Elvis's early hits were basically him singing Black gospel and things like that. So yeah, I think it's important to allow for that. And what's also been good is I've loved on the Beyonce album, like the contribution of country legends. You know, Willie Nelson makes an appearance, so does Dolly Parton. And it's not that Beyonce needed their validity or permission. That's not what it was at all. It was them really acknowledging, yeah, we owe a lot of who we are to the contributions of your ancestors, and we want to acknowledge that, and we want to welcome you into the space. So there was that album that she just released. Beyond the music itself, it says a lot.
Yeah. Well, I I'm often, so the conversation that I generally wind up in around reparations is with other white folks, and
I can't hear you, so I don't know if you are actually recording. I don't know if we're recording your audio or not. I don't know why I can't hear you.
I don't know. Can you hear me now? I'm recording.
I'm keep talking. Muted. It might just be me.
I think it's you. So what I was saying is that generally that when the conversation of reparations comes up, I'm generally, it's around, you know, with other white people, white folks. And, you know, there's always the kind of, there's this initial thing that I don't know that people actually say out loud, but it's like the elephant in the room, that they don't even really know what it means. And so and as we said, reparation is about, you know, mending, it's about repairing, it's about making amends. So you have to actually acknowledge that some wrong was done, and you're there to help repair it. Or as I said at the beginning, to one thing phrase that I hear often that resonates for me, I'm just not sure how you go about it, is to make something whole, right? And repair is to put something back in order, right? To restore it to good condition, to complete condition, right? It's that restoration. You know, we talk about rest, mm-hmm. restore, repair, resist. But I find, you know, after there's some understanding around, okay, what does reparation mean? Like, why? Why is there a need for it? And my response to that is pretty much always, well, you know, to make something whole means that, you know, like I've had access to pretty much you know, what I need and want in life. Not, you know, not talking financially necessarily, but certainly more access than marginalized groups, certainly greater access than Black Americans, you know, Latinx Americans. But it comes back to making reparations, to me, comes back to, you know, everybody has to be raised up. It's not about, you know, slapping my hand because I did something wrong. It's that something was done wrong. And in order to dismantle these systems of oppression, right, it needing to realize reparations. And the word realize means to make real. So, you know, it comes to make something whole means whole for everybody. Means it's not repairing something so I feel better, so white folks are let off the hook. It's repairing something because it's an act of liberation. You know, it's an act of justice and liberation, that because it's not a zero sum game, right? So everybody is raised. And I think that's a huge leap for some people to actually acknowledge that if reparations are made for, say, you know, African Americans, then there's this thought that it's taking away from something else.
Yeah, and we have to, we also, many folks also hold this idea that we have changed laws and things enough so that there is more equity. So, for example, you know, federally supported redlining, or, you know, government sanctioned redlining doesn't happen anymore, right? In terms of housing, in terms of making sure Black people only live in certain neighborhoods next, you know, the lowest value properties next to the chemical plants, and, you know, more exposed to pollution and all that. So so we might say, yeah, that's illegal now, and that doesn't happen, and it's not supported. However, it still does happen. It just happens in different ways. Yeah. We see this when we had the housing bubble. Those subprime loans, many of them were initially targeted towards potential Black homeowners. We see it in ways when, you know, realtors go to give us, you know, assign value on a house people want to sell, and assign in lower values if they know that houses were lived in by Black folk. So there's still ways that, and just using housing as an example, yeah, there's still ways that housing in America is still racially defined, and racially defined in such a way that Black folk and people of color come out on the losing end of it. So reparations could simply look like, can we truly have equitable housing practices? Right. Can we, for example, compensate the folks who were, you know, who lived in areas that were redlined and now have much higher rates of cancer as a result of that? Can we provide more financial aid for their health needs right, as a way? So, you know, things like that. And, you know, folks would say, well, you know, how can you prove that that's what actually caused their cancer? Well, I mean, we got proof. The numbers don't lie.
Well, and, you know, and the other part of that question that I would, you know, like when someone says, well, how do you know, where's the proof? Okay, would you be willing to go live in that neighborhood for 6 months, for a year? And every single person would go, yeah, no. Well, that's exactly. So I don't need more data. It's like asking, you know, white people, would you like to trade places with a Black person? Every single one of them says no.
Yeah.
And they say no because they know what the problem is, but don't want to talk about it. The criminal justice system, right? There's a lot of reparation that could go on in, you know, reforming criminal justice, or criminal injustice, as I hear some people say, you know, our education. Right. It's all of these, you mentioned the redlining, right? It's all these public policies that have robbed Black Americans of the opportunities to build wealth the way that their white peers, you know, have been able to build wealth. And it's not, you know, if I start there, it's not really rocket science. It's just, it has to be, you have to be willing to have the conversation, and you have to be willing to talk about what it means and the different ways it can look. You know, that's what the state of California has been, excuse me, you know, moving in that direction and creating, you know, teams and creating plans and it's not, you know, I don't think it's going to be perfect out of the gate. That's one of the other white body supremacy cultural norms we suffer from in trying to create a plan of something around reparations, is that whatever you bring to the, you know, to the community, whatever's offered, like, it has to be perfect out of the gate. And I don't think it has to be. I think there has to be the gesture toward making something whole. Because if it doesn't work, you'll find out right quick. The other thing is, you run up against, it's not everybody, as we know, you know, Black people and white Americans, they're very far apart on their views of reparations, you know, for slavery. 77% of Black Americans compared with 18% of white Americans support reparations for descendants of enslaved people. That's a huge gap. That's a huge, huge gap. 77% and 18%. And the views for reparations varies, you know, huge, widely, right? The difference is by partisan affiliation as well. People that are Democrats or Democratic leaning independents they're actually split. You know, 48% say that descendants of enslaved people should be repaid in some way, while 49% say they shouldn't be repaid. And yet, you know, so that's at least 48% say something should happen, but only 8% of Republicans in the GOP say that descendants should be repaid, and 91% say they should not. You know, I'm not even sure what to say to that, except that I'm not surprised. Younger adults are more likely than older adults to say that descendants of enslaved people should be repaid. 45% of adults under 30 take this view, compared with 18% of adults 65 and older. So I find that piece of data, that younger adults are more likely than older ones to say that descendants of enslaved people should, you know, should have reparations. And I wonder, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Ogun, but that younger adults are more likely to say that there should be reparations than older. What I wonder about is that older people are more likely, potentially more likely to say, well, this is just how it's always been. Like, they've lived their whole life making, you know, just doing whatever to get by, and just like, well, you know, this is how it is. This is how I grew up. It's not fair. I get it. And it's kind of how it is, you know, kind of making excuses for this, you know, for racism, because that's what, you know, you've lived in for your whole life. And I think younger people are like, okay, that might be true, but that's not, we're not doing that anymore.
And we see that in other areas as well. We see that when it comes to LGBTQ
yes.
Plus issues as well, like younger generations feeling more permissions to be visible and be themselves. But a lot of this also comes from over time, right? You could have been lynched from being Black. You could have been beaten to death as someone found out you were queer. And there were laws on the books that supported that. And over time, thanks to the hard work of activists, as those laws have changed, it kind of has been, at least, you know, from a government standpoint, it's been safer for people to be more visible, more vocal. And now it's just a matter, fingers crossed, of the attitudes of other people to catch up to it as well. We saw this, you know, we went through this with same-sex marriage, and arguably we're going through this with women's reproductive health care again. What's interesting, though, is that reparations at a federal level is it's not a new idea. It's been done in the States before. Japanese who were interned here in the States during World War II, they received compensation. They received reparations. They were actually paid like $1.5 billion were paid to Japanese folk. Native Americans were granted, there's still a lot of restorative work to be done there, but Native American folks have received land and money over time as sort of like compensation for their forced relocation as well. So they've benefited as well. Even part of through the Marshall Plan, Jews were compensated for the Holocaust horrors in different ways. So the idea of actively supporting reparations is not foreign to the States.
Right.
It's particularly noticeable that there's a resistance to do it when it comes to Black people, because I think that it's folks. So let me back up. So this reminds me of a recent meme that's been making the rounds, where, you know, like the MAGA folk are calling DEI the "didn't earn it" sort of deal. So it's that misguided idea that folks are being hired simply because they're not white.
Right.
As opposed to going like, these non-white folks are just as equally skilled as white folks, but we've had a tradition of not hiring them because they're not white. So now we're going to be a little more equitable in our hiring practices. But of course they have to be skilled. They have to meet the basic, you know, bar for entry of being skilled in what the job position is. So just to say they're being hired because they're Black and may not be skilled enough is a racist dog whistle. Where was I going with that? Oh yeah. So the fact that there seems to be this major opposition to having reparations for the descendants of Black enslaved people is fairly telling about the anti-Blackness that there is in the States. And I think I mentioned the DEI thing, because for someone who is white in America to say DEI means didn't earn it, when you look at the generational wealth that has been passed down for a lot of white Americans who didn't earn it, but rather it was exploited from Black labor, and relocation of Native Americans and all the things, there was like, yeah, there wasn't a lot of earning there either. So I find it kind of sadly ironic that's what they're catching on to now, that DEI means didn't earn it. So I think that if the US really wanted to pay attention to this, that they would. Like I said, because they've done it before. So I think it's a willful case of saying, yeah, we're not gonna throw this lifeline to Black Americans. I mentioned earlier the thing about now everybody can earn or find themselves in a work position because we have, you know, anti-racist hiring practices. But again, those are maybe on in writing, but not always in practice. Hence, you know, the recent DEI initiatives to go like, yeah, we say we don't discriminate in our hiring, but yet almost everyone, and especially leadership positions, are white. So maybe we do discriminate. Maybe we should take a look at that. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. So even that in itself can be considered under the umbrella of reparations, that intentional reexamining of hiring practices, of compensation practices, all those things.
Well, the you know, part of our kind of research for today was also looking at Pew Research did a back in late 2022. You know, they do, Pew Research does these massive data collections and surveys, and they're quite detailed. And this is the, you know, some of the data that I've talked, that I've been mentioning comes from that. Black and white Americans are far apart. The interesting place, though, that where two things that I found fascinating and in part disheartening was that so white people are pretty much split down the middle around this, about the legacy of slavery affecting the U.S. And for white folks, they say not much or not at all. For Black Americans, they're saying a great deal or a fair amount. So it's like 48-50. And I'm like, really? I know you're always telling me, you know, you're always reminding me of, you know, how to not everybody thinks this way or not everybody knows this. But I just found that a little disturbing that, you know, half of white people, you know, walking around don't think that, you know, slavery is still not much or not at all, you know, impacting, you know, current today.
Yeah.
But the good news thing about, I mean, and there's an awful lot in this research, but the thing that I found really uplifting was of people that believe and support reparations say, one, they say the federal government should be responsible. And they're talking about, you know, in part repayment. So that the financial money piece. But then they also, people that support the reparations also looked at it from, you know, well, you know, what policies can be in place to, you know, put into practice to help small businesses? What can be, you know, what policies can be changed or put into practice for at, you know, colleges and universities so that education is, you know, accessible, just as accessible, and, you know, help in sort of wealth building. And so those two things really, and housing, you know, as you mentioned, the financial assistance with home buying or remodeling. And I thought that was, you know, like if I wanted to engage in reparations in my own little way, I could support, you know, and not all of my money has to go to one place, and maybe a little of it goes to, you know, Small Business Administration or what's going on locally that I can support small business growth. And what's going on locally with colleges and universities that, you know, that historically have always benefited from slavery. It's mostly enslaved people that built all our universities. So it's, while it can sound like this really big thing, like, I don't know what I can do, what I found hopeful in all that data was at least these two places around, you know, small businesses and education, that I could in my local area have, you know, add a little, you know, make a little bit of an impact, at least for one person or two people.
Yeah. I think it's important that we diversify our views. Ooh, excuse me, had a sneeze. It's important that we expand our thinking around, again, what reparations means. and be okay with it. And as you mentioned earlier, to really examine our thinking around like the zero sum gain that to help one group of people means that you're hurting another group, as opposed to, you know, to help one group come up to the same level as everyone and benefits everyone.
Right.
But you know, we've been part of capitalism's lie is to have us believe that there's only a limited amount of resources.
Right.
There's only, you know, that has to be split between all of us. And also there's also the American dream / gaslight, which tells us that, you know, we have to, everyone has the potential to pull themselves up by the bootstraps and like become a millionaire.
Right.
And that's the goal, which again, easier for those who are starting off with a few generations of family wealth behind them, versus those who are not. You know, not too long ago, a friend of mine posted a meme that talks, it was very, what's the word I want? Sexist meme, misogynistic meme about the wives, the recently divorced wives of billionaires. So like, Jeff Bezos's previous wife, I forget who else was on there, but it was a picture with these women. Yeah, this picture of these women talking about, you know, they earned their money because they just got divorced, versus the men they were married to who built their companies and worked hard to, you know, have become billionaires, and these women just divorced them. And I was like, okay. And we have to remember that when Jeff Bezos, when he started Amazon, right, loan from his dad, and then he also asked his siblings for like 10 grand each to invest into the company. So there wasn't a, you know, he was like delivering pizzas on the side and saved money and built Amazon out of his garage with the money he saved from pizza delivery. No, there was generational wealth in his family. Right. And it may not have been billions, but there was enough that his family members could loan him monies to invest and start this business. And now, you know, because of their early investment, now they're billionaires. Talk about they didn't earn it. They're billionaires just by sitting around watching Amazon grow. So it's,
and I think it was Bezos' ex-wife who responded to that meme by doubling her philanthropic donations.
Yes, I believe she's now one of the, I think in the US, if not the world, like one of the biggest philanthropists, because of how much money she's given away out of those, you know, hundreds of millions that she got as a result of the divorce settlement. So when we talk about the you know, the entitlements and or, you know, that those generational wealth gaps between Black Americans and white Americans isn't going to be closed simply by Black Americans going out and having the same jobs.
Yeah.
And it's important to close that gap because, again, when, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. So it's important to close that gap, because what else are, you know, when we have more wealthy Black folk, this is going to be people spending more money and putting back into the economy. The shift in the zero sum game mentality is, that's going to be a huge hurdle, because that's what's constantly being perpetuated in our culture. When we see millionaires and billionaires getting richer, especially during COVID times, and other folk and traditionally marginalized folk and Black folk are not, because again, there's that generational wealth.
Well, that equity gap just got bigger and bigger.
Yes. Yes.
And for, you know, Black Americans and other, you know, racial or ethnic groups, and also destroyed middle class. So as a, you know, a white person, I was, you know,
yeah.
having to fight, you know, to keep a roof over my head. And I'm not saying it was, you know, if I was a Black person, I don't really know how much worse it would have been. I just, you know, there is some ripple effect in that equity gap that also affects white folks.
And I think in order for reparations for Black Americans to happen, it's going to require, you know, the, like to call it this point, the mythical racial reckoning of America and acknowledging not just the horrors of slavery, which I think that's kind of happened to some extent, but the impact that slavery still has in how we do America today. And I think that's the one that's given the most resistance to admit that it's still at play. So part of it involves that as well. But I don't think you have to go there to realize that reparations are needed. I mean, just look at, again, all the things we're talking about, the racial wealth gap, income disparity, all those things. Yeah, if you believe that those are issues that need to be addressed, then you can believe in the case for reparations.
Yep.
So I think next week we're going to take a deeper dive into this when we start talking about decolonizing wealth, and we take a look at the Decolonizing Wealth Project. But part of what we'd like to invite you to do, and I think we alluded to this earlier, is, you know, instead of just waiting for the government to do something about it, to really take a look at how we as individuals can contribute to this journey of reparations. Again, where do we do our shopping? Who do we do our buying from? Who do we help? Where do we give our donations to? All those things go towards a consciousness of reparations, and in many ways, reparations from the ground up.
Yep. That's how it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen like federal level down.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm me too. Me too. Me too as well. Yes. Prepare. This is your trigger warning. We're going to talk about decolonizing your wealth next week. Yeah. So those of you who have wealth,
right.
this is your trigger warning,
right.
For that. Thank you for listening. As always, head over to projectsanctus.com to see all the opportunities you have. Get your self-learning on through our Conscious Anti-Racism Self-Based Course. Join our affinity groups. And yes, start your reading for our 846 Book Club Inverse Cowgirl starting on April 15th. You should have had your taxes done by then. So nothing standing in your way for joining us. For those who said, I don't have time to read, I got to get my taxes together. Taxes should be done by then. Please tell your folks about your friends and family and all your folks about the podcast. You can find us wherever you find your podcasts or online at withloveandjusticeforall.podbean.com. So until we meet again,
let's get our holy on.